So guerrilla marketing goes green starts out with some basic principles. And the one that I like the best, which I think is actually if we all followed this rule, the world would be a far better place. And that's the golden rule. Now, some people look at the golden rule as do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. But others say you should not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. Which one do you think is the one that you would follow here?
I'd actually twist it around and do it even a little bit differently and say, do unto others as they would like you to do. Because we are all each individuals, and we have different personality styles, we have different ways of being in the world, and what might be the perfect way to treat me might not be the perfect way to treat you. So if I treat you as I want to be treated, I may leave you feeling kind of frustrated.
And you say that it actually works in business.
Very much so. In fact, the more you ground yourself in ethical and green principles in business, and I do go into quite a bit of detail in Guerrilla Marketing Goes Green on this, the better chances you have of succeeding. Doors open to you that would not be open to a cold-hearted, bottom-line-only kind of marketer. Opportunities to make partnerships. And, of course, the ability to build a much more loyal customer base. And to actually turn those folks into fans and evangelists and people going out and almost selling for you, you know, telling people that they've really got to do business with you because you're just that kind of company that inspires that kind of loyalty. You don't do that by being just selfish and cruel and cutthroat and all the other things that too many people are taught to do in their MBA classes.
Well, I mean, that's a very nice sentiment and a very nice thought. But if it's true, why isn't everybody doing it?
I ask myself that every day. But I'll give you a very specific example. For 10 years, the bulk of my business was writing resumes here in the Pioneer Valley of Massachusetts. And, you know, typically what would happen is somebody would enter that market and I'd give a friendly phone call and we'd have a little chat and I'd kind of tell them my thoughts about where there was room in the market for another person in that business. And we would have this amicable relationship where then if someone needed a resume and I couldn't do it, I would know who to turn to and give that name. And likewise, I still get quite a few referrals from some of my competitors in that business, which is at this point a fairly small part of what I do. And one year, this guy opened up a shop in Sunderland, big retail shop, and I gave my standard hello call, and he was not friendly, and in fact, he was kind of hostile. And I started my business in 1981. We are now in 2010. I'm still here. He didn't make it 1 year. He was gone by the next phone book.
So that's an object lesson. Before you said that this green marketing is basically becoming mainstream. And you say that when price and quality are equal, 76% of consumers would switch brands or retailers to a company associated with a good cause. But isn't that the rub? I mean, doesn't it cost more to have products that are green and aren't they sold at a premium?
Well, that's the wonderful thing, Francesca, is it doesn't have to. Yes, there are ways that you can go green that do cost a lot of money, but there are also ways that go green that actually save you considerable amounts of money. On a very small scale example, a couple of years ago, I needed a new printer, and I finally found one I'd been looking for a long time that does duplexing. That is, it prints on both sides of the page. Now, I buy recycled paper at $50 a carton. So for me, the fifth time I didn't print a ream of paper, which was probably, I don't know, 8 months after I bought the printer, it paid for itself in paper savings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, look at a huge company, Walmart. They don't come too much huger. Walmart, for purely selfish reasons, has done a lot of very green initiatives. Among other things, they changed their truck fleet around so that they have auxiliary little motors to heat and cool the cabs when they're at a truck stop for hours and hours, and they don't have to run those huge diesels and get 0 miles a gallon. Now, Walmart is not a company I consider to be terribly socially conscious. Walmart is not a company that appeals to the environmentalist demographic. Walmart is doing this pure and simply to save money.
And yet you bring up an important point. In fact, you know, on the one hand, Walmart has been very influential, is really pushing sustainability and better green practices, not only in its own stores, not only practicing it, but also pushing it on its supply chain. On the other hand, the very business model of Walmart, which is, sourcing from very far away. It has a huge carbon footprint. And there are also, there are also other ways in which it's not so corporately responsible. So how does that fit into your model of green marketing?
Well, I personally don't choose to shop there. And I think over time, what's interesting is I think over time they're going to be forced to become more ethical because the green initiatives that they're doing will kind of sneak up behind them and hook them by the collar and say, hey, wait a minute, if you're really a green company, these practices of labor relations in China and these practices of the impact on local economies in all the places they open and, in fact, all the places where they then later close and leave these empty shells of stores, all of these issues are going to have to start to come around just as, like, now it's no longer acceptable to be a polluter. 40, 50 years ago, that was considered a corporate right. This is a changing universe, and as people become more aware, we will find, and actually there's a nice section in Guerrilla Marketing Goes Green on Visioning the Future that's one of my favorite parts of the book in Chapter 19.
I'll talk about that a little bit.
That if we look at taking sustainability initiatives to their natural logical conclusion, we look at creating a world in which there's no need to go to war over petroleum products. We look at a world in which hunger becomes much less of an issue because food can be redistributed better and grown locally at the source. And, you know, in every little facet of life, all of these things, transportation, agriculture, housing, all of these things add up to a very different kind of society in little gradual increments. And I'm very, very, very excited about that possibility. And I see in the last 40, 50 years, tremendous progress already. We've got a long way to go, but oh my goodness, we've come far.
You know, I think one of the problems, as I hear you talk and as I read your book, Guerrilla Marketing Goes Green, you have wonderful principles and guides and a lot of very good information, a lot of very good detailed suggestions for companies who are really committed to this path and how they can market themselves in ways in which they can, you know, talk their walk as well as walk their talk.
Yeah, because it's very important to tell the world what you're doing. I like to talk about the example of Markel Paper. Markel went recycled for all of their paper products, you know, toilet paper, paper towels, napkins. Would you like to guess the year?
About 30 years ago?
Try 60 years ago. But the thing is, they didn't tell anybody. I was just speaking in Davos, Switzerland, and I used them as the key case study on my speech on communicating the value in your values. And, you know, it wasn't until the mid-2000s that they started to have any kind of prominence on their packaging about the recycling. And it wasn't until 2009 that they really changed over the whole brand so that the fundamental message was paper from paper, not from trees, save a million trees. And that was a much higher level benefit than buy my toilet paper. And it's not surprising to me that having made that rebranding effort, they've gone from bankruptcy to category leader.
Great. Well, put that into a principle for us then.
It's a polar principle, if you will. One of the poles is that you should take green initiatives and you should especially take the low-hanging fruit where it's going to not cost you or even save you money and resources, and you're really foolish not to do it. And then you should make sure that the world does know what you're doing. And you mentioned before that environmentally friendly products are often at a premium price. And right now, business owners can still do that. It'll become harder as more and more people shift that way. But right now, if that is your pricing model, you do have a little bit more room to play if you have a green commitment that people will spot you the higher price and be willing to pay it in a way that they wouldn't be if they felt it was just about putting money in your pocket.
Well, that brings me around to then my question that I was going to ask. And that is, you pose the idea of an abundance model, not a prosperity model, but an abundance model. I think what you're really talking about there is quality over sometimes quantity. Well, first tell us, what is this abundance model? And then I'll follow up with my question.
Okay. It's the idea that there's enough to go around. We have in the world enough food. We have enough energy. We have all of these commodities or non-commodities in more than adequate supply. We don't have the distribution worked out. So right now, the challenge, I think, is to show the world that we have enough of this, that nobody needs to go hungry, that there's enough energy falling out of the sky every day from the sun, just the sun, never mind wind and hydro and all the other technologies, just from the sun, there's enough falling on this country every day to power us for a whole year, all of our energy needs. So looking at this, there's enough to go around. And what that means in terms of business relationships is that the idea of market share is no longer as relevant as people thought it was. What does it matter to me if you also are at capacity, if I'm at capacity?
Say more about that.
Okay. I'm a service business. I do copywriting and consulting. The universe of the number of possible jobs out there is enormous. The universe that I can fill and still get sleep and still have a life is, I don't know, 0.00001%.
So of that.
The market share concept really doesn't apply in my kind of business at all. I don't need to have any kind of measurable market share. I just need to have enough work to keep me busy.
But you also say in your book that you think of abundance as far more than the amount of money that you just bring home.
Oh, yes, yes. Abundance has a lot to do with the quality of your life and the quality of your earth. Just as an example, I see a lot of concerts and plays, and I see many of them for free as an usher. That's a way of adding abundance to my life while keeping the money in my wallet.
So the question is this, when we're talking about, we're talking about capitalism here, where the drive is to maximize profit, how does that square with the green economy, with even the green marketing and walking your talk that you put forward in this book? If you're not maximizing, in other words, I guess I'm asking, is there something else that a business can get in return for perhaps maximizing its profit?
Well, first of all, I want to make it very clear, Francesca, that you can have your cake and eat it too here. You can maximize your profit and still be very ecological. In fact, in many cases, it's easier. If you have the green principles in your products and services, you're going to have a much easier time staying profitable and increasing your profit. We talked briefly about the higher margins that you can charge. There are a number of other reasons why this is true: better customer loyalty, more willingness for other people to partner with you and bring you to their audiences and their markets, which to me is one of the most exciting principles of marketing, because it costs nothing and it opens up enormous leverage, and it really does come from that place of abundance.
And yet, what if you are Walmart and you've now gotten the corporate social responsibility, commitment. You're committed to it, and you realize you're not paying a livable wage. Now you want to begin to pay all of your workers all around the world a livable wage, including here. You want to provide decent benefits. Isn't that going to cut into your profits?
Not necessarily, because if those bigger wages are co-introduced with some productivity situations, you might be getting more work out of that worker while you're paying them more, because the worker will have more incentive to do a better job for you. And there's obviously training pieces that come with this. But I think, you know, Walmart is not necessarily the example we want to look at as a model anyway. But
yeah, you have some models in the book. You have some that are smaller and some that are bigger. Why don't we start with one of the smaller companies? Tell us about Barbara Waugh.
Barbara Waugh worked, I'm not sure if she still does, at Hewlett-Packard. And she was originally hired to bring in a bunch of engineers on a sort of small local project. She came out of a 60s and 70s social change action background, not the typical corporate hire. And she spent quite a few years at Hewlett-Packard building alliances across people who she had originally perceived as possibly her enemy, increasing that company's penetration in social change and corporate social responsibility. And the funny thing is, after each one of these projects, when the dust settled, she usually had a promotion, a bigger salary, more people under her. It was really quite fascinating.
And why?
Because the stuff works. Because this was really good for Hewlett-Packard's profile in the audiences they were trying to reach. Being able to, for example, really validate the women in their company, the engineers who had been kind of shoved to the side by the men. We're talking, some decades back, where it was not necessarily the common logic to value women employees as much as the men. So she was basically able to continually push the line forward and forward and forward within that company, and eventually help the company embark on some worldwide initiatives, such as bringing computers to developing countries in ways that they had not been there before, that were profitable for the company and opened up huge new horizons and audiences for people using Hewlett-Packard products, some of them being donated, but the expectation was that later those people will come back and buy.
That's a great example. Now, as a counterexample, talk a little bit about Nestle, because you talk about greenwashing in the book, and there's some traps there.
Yes, there are. And Guerrilla Marketing Goes Green has a big section on how not to do greenwashing. And I'm actually going to quickly find that section of the book because I don't want to get my statistics wrong. So Nestle, 120. So this was a situation where Nestle got hauled into court because of an ad they had about their bottled water. And I'll just read a little bit about this. Mm-hmm. Look what happened to Nestle after it ran an ad promoting one of its bottled water brands as an eco-friendly alternative in the Toronto Globe and Mail. Five major environmental groups lodged an official complaint charging violation of the Canadian Code of Advertising Standards, as well as environmental claims guidelines set by Canada's Competition Bureau and the Canadian Standards Association. The legal complaint cites three claims in the ad. Number one, most water bottles avoid landfill sites and are recycled. False claim number two, bottled water is the most environmentally responsible consumer product in the world. And false claim number three, Nestle Pure Life is a healthy, eco-friendly choice. Now, I do talk, I analyze this for a bit, and I quote one of the public action groups that was involved in the lawsuit, and then I come back with how they could have avoided this problem. And I say Nestle could have easily avoided the specific Canadian complaint and result in bad publicity.
So what could they have done differently?
Well, instead of saying most water bottles are recycled, they could have said many. Bottled water could be considered an environmentally friendly. And that's, by the way, very much open to debate. And there's huge, if you go online and look for the environmental consequences of bottled water, you'll find reams of material to read that cast some doubt on that claim. And, you know, pure, clean water, such as Nestle's brand, would be a healthy choice. And particularly that would be true in places where the water might not be safe to drink. Mm-hmm. But those were not the claims they made. They made far more sweeping claims, and they got into trouble for it.
So you're saying you need to use the right language. But you go a little bit further than that, too. What you're saying is that you want to make sure that you are being genuine.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's not enough to just, you know, put a smile on your face and say we're green, we're building nuclear power plants, we're cutting up forests for biofuel, we're, you know, poisoning the earth, but we're doing it with a smile on our face. No.
Or even fudging your language a little bit so that you don't come up against greenwashing claims while you're still, your actions are still maybe a little bit less than green.
Yeah, well, of course, green is a continuum. And we all can be making more progress on going green in our own personal lives. How we brush our teeth can, for most people, particularly in the Northeast, be done with considerably less water than most people use, as just one example. You know, it's everything is a choice. And at what point do you say enough, enough, enough? And at one point you say, I can do more, I can do more. And I find that even for me, and I've been in this movement for, oh my goodness, what, 35 years, I'm still evolving.
Yeah, that's for sure. We all could do better. Now, another interesting point you make in the book is, on the one hand, more of the green message is going local, but you also say that global as green is an important thing. Explain to us how that works.
Yeah, these are two adjoining sections in the chapter called Marketing Green. I think it's chapter 13. And first I talk about the Buy Local movement and about groups like Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, which is a national organization of buying local groups, and how that keeps money in the local economy and how you can be having marketing points about that too. But then the next section is on Global as Green. If you do have a business that is globally based, there's a lot of things you can be doing to make sure that your business is socially and environmentally responsible, is giving back to the communities in which you're sourcing ingredients or getting labor or whatever it is that you're doing over there. A local example that is one of my favorite companies from right here in the Valley is Dean's Beans up in Orange, Massachusetts. And Dean's Beans was maybe the first, and certainly one of the first, coffee roasters in the country and in the world to go from day one 100% organic, 100% fair trade. So, and he takes a lot of the profits from the coffee that he's growing in places like Kenya and Guatemala.
Dean Saikon.
Dean Saikon, yes. And he is putting that money back into the community in very sustainable and very locally focused ways with local governance. He's not coming in and saying, you people need a well. He's saying, what do you need? Oh, we need a well. Okay. It's a very different model from a lot of the kind of traditionally philanthropic approaches, because it's really based on an empowerment culture.
Yeah, that's a great example. You make another important point, I think, too, and that is that companies that want to sell on the international market, let's say, you give the example of cosmetics manufacturers who might want to be selling their products in Europe. Tell us how going green is an advantage there.
Well, it's very simple. If you do not meet the much, much stricter European standards, you can't sell there. And what that means to American companies is that they should be meeting the European standards and then coming to the domestic market and saying, look at us, we're certified to sell in Europe, and most cosmetics are not. We're really clean and green, and you should be buying our stuff and not this other stuff.
Well, that's great. Now, is there any last message you'd like to leave us with here about Green Guerrilla Marketing? If you could sum it up, what might be the most important takeaway that we can get from your book?
The most important takeaway from Guerrilla Marketing Goes Green is that doing the right thing is actually really good for business. And in hundreds of pages of fairly easy to digest examples, I show over and over again how in every aspect of business, doing the right thing ends up putting more money in the company's pocket and giving you a better base to move forward from, the ability to build those kinds of partnerships we touched on before, the ability to change your audience from consumers to fans to actually ambassadors. Doing the right thing is really good for business. And if you don't believe me, read the book.
That's great. Thanks so much, Shel.
We should mention that the website for the book is guerrillamarketinggoesgreen.com, and there's a nice big fat package of extra stuff you get from there, too.
That's great. We'll definitely link to that.